Welcome to The Partial Historians.
We explore all the details of ancient Rome.
Everything from political scandals to love affairs, the battles waged, and when citizens turn against each other. I'm Dr. Rad.
And I'm Dr. G. We consider Rome as the Romans saw it by reading different ancient authors and comparing their accounts.
Join us as we trace the journey of Rome from the founding of the city.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of The Partial Historians. I am one of your hosts, Dr. G.
And I'm a very excited Dr. Rad because we're trying out a new setup.
This may or may not succeed.
This could be the most interesting episode audiologically.
We want to say a huge shout out thank you to our Patreons because it is through their support that we were able to invest in some new equipment and everybody's going to hear the results for better or worse.
We are audio geniuses. Of course, it's going to work out.
It's going to be amazing. Just you wait.
Yes. Now, Dr. G, we are tracing the journey of Rome from the founding of the city, and I owe you and all of our listeners a big apology.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Did you break the history of Rome from the founding of the city somehow?
I may just have. So last episode, I left you all on a cliffhanger with our dictator of 418 BC about to march out into battle. And I said I was finishing there because I thought we were heading into a new year. Turns out I was wrong.
Oh, no.
I know. I got confused because, you see, 417 and 416 are blended together. But 418 is, in fact, quite distinct.
I have terrible news for you. You're going to have to hand back in your PhD.
Oh, no. I'll just be Rad. Dr. Rad. I hate it.
I'm sorry.
I know. All right. So when we do the recap, therefore, this episode, I am going to not only recap what happened last time, but also add some more information.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, let's get into where were we up to in this narrative anyway?
Well, so I believe we were up to 418 BCE last episode. And we ended up with some military tribunes with consular power who could not get along to save themselves.
Tragedy. Yeah. Look, you know, arguments abound. Poor strategic decisions were made.
It wasn't great. And there was a man who was the father of one of these gentlemen, Quintus Servilius. Sounds like I'm making fun of him whenever I use that V, but...
I mean, that's his name.
I know, but it just sounds funny, like Quintus Servilius.
Is he asking for ridicule? Perhaps.
Especially if I add on Quintus Servilius Periscus.
Fidinus.
I know. So this guy had seen that there was going to be trouble because it's actually only been, what, like maybe 6 or 7 years, maybe 8 max, since we last had an issue where the commanders were arguing and it led to military disaster for Rome. So he sees the writing on the wall, allegedly, and he basically makes sure that he and his son are going to be there and prepared to kind of step in and handle the situation which he thinks is going to arise, which is military disaster for the Romans.
This is a typical elitist plan. Not only is he going to get himself into power, he's going to bring his son along with him and it's all going to be great.
It does seem suspicious that he and his son are the ones that, you know, come in to do the whole "here we come to save the day" thing.
I mean, yeah, I have some concerns, but, you know, 418 being what it is, chaotic, fine. Fine.
Yes, exactly. So essentially the way that they did this is they made sure that not every available man had been sent out to face the Romans' enemies, who I should add are the Aquians and the people of Labici.
The Labicani, yes, who re-entered the narrative as one of these sort of like surrounding neighbors who is a little bit upset with Rome for the way that Rome has treated them over and over again.
And I think from what you said last time, they've been nursing this grudge for almost 100 years now.
Pretty much as soon as the Republic started, they've been upset.
Yeah, exactly. So in 418 BCE, last episode, we finished up with our dictator, Quintus Servilius, and his master of the horse, which is his son, therefore another Servilius, marching out together to face the enemy with fresh troops after things predictably not going so well for the Romans. Yeah.
Yes, coming in to save the day.
Exactly. Now, I did hint that the Aquians were in for some trouble at the end of last episode because they had been doing so well against the Romans because, you know, the Romans are just too busy fighting to, well, fighting each other, I should say, than to fight. That they also started to get sloppy.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
The results of this were seen immediately, Dr. G. In the very first battle, you could see that the Aquians and their allies, the people of the Labacani, are off their game.
A little bit of a mess. A hot mess waiting to happen in the Castelli Romani region.
Yeah. So the dictator, Quintus Servilius, he goes into battle, leading hard with the cavalry, and the cavalry caused the entire front line of the Aquians to be disrupted. They're in chaos, Dr. G. I know.
Oh, well, a dictator shows up and everybody runs for the hills.
Basically. Now, this guy is super hardcore because wait till I add this detail. So once they've sent the front lines of the Aquians and the Labacani into chaos, he orders that the Romans sort of quick march and just advance quickly. I guess the idea being to sort of overwhelm them as fast as possible. And apparently one of the standard bearers kind of like hesitates. Now, I don't know if this means he's like, wait, left, right? Where are we going? I don't know what kind of hesitation he's giving. Like, did he cry?
Can we stop at gelato, guys? Because I really need a break right now.
Yeah, I don't know what the hesitation was, but whatever it was, Servilius, our dictator, does not take it kindly, and he has him killed on the spot.
I would have thought that would be a bad omen. The standard bearer is a very important person. They're looking after the standard.
I know. It seems so weird, but he was like, he's had him cut down on the spot.
I feel like the Romans who had viewed that would be shocked and traumatized.
Well, apparently they're very excited, Dr. G. That's what they are.
Gross.
They're very excited. And so
these people would never cease to amaze me with their horrors.
Yeah, they're just like, you know what? We're just going to give it our all. And so the Aquians and the Labacani are quickly overwhelmed. They lose the battle. They flee the battlefield. They run back to their camp. Oh, how the tables have turned.
So you're telling me that in the time of you've got to like get the troops roused up somehow, that the best way to do that is to kill one of their own.
Well, I don't know if they're excited because of the standard bearer's death. They're just excited because it seems that they're doing well, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And I think they are probably invigorated by the energy of Quintus Servilius, which is stern.
So invigorating.
Exactly. Mm. Silver fox, you know.
Yeah. Servilius, sir, yes, sir.
Yeah. So the Romans are able to quite easily also capture the camp of the enemy. And of course, within the camp, there are many spoils to be had.
Oh, booty.
It is booty time.
I wonder where that leather armor went.
Yes, as we have often pointed out, because they are fighting the same people and over again, we really feel like their possessions are just in rotation.
It is tough out there. It takes a long time to make a full suit of armor.
Yeah.
Of course you want to steal it back.
So Servilius, I guess to show his gratitude, says that the soldiers may have the booty.
Very generous.
I know, I know. Now, the Roman cavalry, meanwhile, they are hard at work. They are chasing the Aquians, well, the remaining ones, I suppose, as they run away from the camp. They've just been running all day, Dr. G.
It's tough out there. I mean, they're in a hilly region. It's not like this is an easy run.
I know. And they come back and inform our dictator, Servilius, that the remaining Aquians and the Labacani who've managed to survive the slaughter up until this moment are all hiding in Labici. Big surprise.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, that's where I would hide as well, with Rome's known enemy, who was also involved in the battle, but currently not being chased.
Yeah, exactly.
Best place to hide.
So the Romans march off to Labici the next day, have a bit of a rest beforehand. They quickly encircle it, use ladders to get over the walls, and completely ravage the city.
Oh.
Yeah, it's all over very quickly.
I was like, yeah, I didn't even have a reaction to that. I'm just like, really? That's it?
It's so quick because Livy is very precise in his details here. So Servilius marches back to Rome with his triumphant army. And once he gets there, he hands back his powers. And he had been dictator, Livy tells me, for a total of 8 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is an exceptionally fast campaign.
I know, right?
I mean, it would take at least until lunch on the first day to march there.
Yeah, so it's considering that it's built up as being obviously, you know, a potential disaster for Rome, typically, a bit suspiciously, the Romans bounce back very quickly and very easily.
This is their way. They love a good bounce back.
Or is it just the way that their history has been written?
Look, I cannot possibly comment at this time on that issue.
I demand answers. Now, obviously, we actually finally have a bit of expansion on our hands, Dr. G.
Do we?
We do.
Oh, my goodness. And still in 418.
Yeah. This is all 418.
Wow.
Yeah. So the Senate are concerned because we now have the city of Labici in our evil imperialist claws. But there are concerns because you know who else would like to have Labici?
Is it the Aquians?
No.
The Labicani, the people who used to live there?
I'm sure there are lots of people that would like to have it.
But the Volscians.
I mean, within Rome,
Who
would most like to have?
People who would most like to have it in Rome.
Yeah.
The military tribunes with consular power. I don't know.
Well, kind of. But the people that the Senate are most concerned about are, of course, the Tribune of the Plebs and the people themselves.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, they're very concerned that they're going to start eyeing off all this new land that's coming in from the Labican territory. So they very quickly hold a meeting and determine that they will establish a colony there.
So land distribution is not on the table.
Well, I think that's what they foresee.
I see.
And they're like, no, that's not going to happen.
Not on my watch.
No. So 1,500 colonists are sent from Rome to this new colony, and they are apparently given 5/8 of an acre.
Well, that's pretty good. That's more than people get today.
Well, apparently, my commentator thinks that the amount that is specified in Livy would not be enough for a family to survive on, and therefore it's not really correct. So he thinks they would have been given a lot more.
Yeah, it is problematic. It might be enough for one person to grow some things, but I don't know if it's enough for self-sufficiency for a family.
Yes, my commentator, Ogilvie, thinks that this amount that Livy specifies must be more in reference to where his household gods would reside. Like, this is the area in which his household essentially is being established.
As in the building itself.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. And this is like his little, you know, sacred land sort of thing of his gens.
Oh, interesting. Yes.
But, you know, theories. And that is actually where 418 should have ended.
Well, under those circumstances, I'm willing to give Rome one more gold eagle for their expansion.
Well, exactly. I mean, they're still going to get it. They're just going to get it a bit later. But that takes us into 417 BCE for me, Dr. G. Would you like to tell us who the magistrates are? And I should say, I think we probably should go through 417 and 416 together because in my account they are treated as really one and the same.
Foreshadowing.
I know, yeah.
Hey, listeners. Do you enjoy awkward family dynamics? Relationships between mortals and gods? Then you will love our book, Rex, the Seven Kings of Rome. Rex is newly available in an ebook in the Amazon Kindle store and also on Gumroad. However, if you're keen to get your hands on a printed copy, we still have a few left and they are now being sold through Abbey's Bookstore in Sydney. And thanks so much to all those who've already bought a copy. We really appreciate your support. And now, back to the episode.
It is 417 BCE. Da, 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 da. We have military tribunes with consular power. So first cab off the rank, Publius Lucretius Hosti Tricipitinus.
Oh, I hate that name.
I do not like this name. He has returned and I still don't like it.
Ironically, Tricipitinus does not trip off the tongue.
No indeed. Previously military tribune with consular power in 419. So very recent that we've had this sort of horror of pronunciation upon us. He is joined by Agrippa Menenius Lanatus,
mm-hmm.
also previously consul in 439 and also previously military tribune with Tricipitinus, that old chestnut, in 419. So these two, it's like being reunited for a whole new adventure.
It is interesting that he had a gap of 20 years, seemingly, between holding magistracies until Tricipitinus is on the scene.
Are you raising suspicions about Roman naming conventions?
It might be.
Fair enough. And we also have Gaius, or potentially Lucius, Servilius Auxilla, or Structus. This guy, I mean, we don't know. I mean, he's all over the shop name-wise. But the good news is that he's on year three of his hat trick of military tribunes with consular power. Not that he got to do much the previous year because he kind of got swept up in the whole being master of the horse instead business.
Yeah, so this is the son of our dictator.
This is the son of our dictator. Yeah. So he was the one who was hanging around as the master of the horse in Rome last year.
Yes.
418.
Yes.
The name confusion continues unabated with this guy.
This last guy is a tricky one, yeah.
There is also Spurius Rutilus Crassus. Mm. And I offer this with massive question marks.
Indeed.
Because it seems more likely that the fourth guy is not a Rutilius Crassus, but is a Spurius Veturius Crassus Sinurinus. Sinurinus.
Or Securinus. No,
Securinus?
Securinus.
I mean, I don't know. But the problem with it being a Rutilius Crassus is that this is very much a plebeian name.
Yes.
And
we're not there yet, as we've established many, many episodes.
Scholars don't agree on many things, but one of the things that they tend to agree on is that this is way too early for there to actually be a plebeian in this role.
Unless, of course, it's all crap and the Roman state isn't established the way everyone said it is, and plebeians and patricians, do they exist at this point in time? Who knows?
I'll have more to say on that topic later this episode. So the trouble with the Rutilius thing is that there's no Rutilii in the Fasti as we are aware of it for another 250 years.
Yeah, and with Roman naming conventions, it feels really unlikely that you would just have one random guy from a family pop up and then no one in the family pop up again for hundreds of years.
This is something that you build over time and family reputation gets sort of baked in. And so you're expecting a slow progression of people to come into positions and then to be followed through by their relatives.
Yeah.
And that's not what we see in this case. We don't get a Rutilii for ages. The Prinum and Spurius doesn't go with this gens historically from the examples that we do have. Neither does the Cognomen Crassus.
Yes, exactly.
So it's all just kind of speculation and wildness and probably not a plebeian. Sad news, because we're pro-plebeian on this podcast, it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
And that is not what we're getting in 417 BCE. No.
So should we do 416, or do you have enough information to separate those years out?
Don't be like that. What I can tell you is, in terms of my source material, is that I have a little excerpt from the Fasti Capitolini, which basically proves that Lucretius Hosti is somebody that we should care about. Likewise, Agrippa Menenius, and otherwise everybody else is up for grabs. And that Diodorus Siculus appears to be more on top of the names than Livy. How the tables have turned.
No, I refuse to concede defeat.
I don't know. People better the place than me seem to think that Diodorus Siculus has got the information right this time.
Fair enough, fair enough. Look, it's not like Livy hasn't made a mistake with names before.
Ah.
All right, well, shall we go through 416 then? Because as I say, these years are very blended together for me.
Okay, so you've got some blending. I've got a whole bunch of different names for 416.
No, no, I do. Like they are separate, but I mean the narrative is all blended together. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I feel sorry for the aforementioned players of 417.
Sorry. Well, they're going to come into it maybe a tiny little bit. But,
yeah. Bit players at best.
Exactly.
So our people for 416.
Mm-hmm.
We've got military tribunes with consular power again.
Yep.
Aulus Sempronius Atratinus.
A name we know well by now.
Yeah, previously consul in 428. not a named consul, but one of the sort of Suffolk consuls,
mm.
and also a military tribune in 425 and 420. My other note is that despite his appearance in many years, he doesn't appear to have distinguished himself in any particular way.
Well, this is the guy, I think, who was accused of holding fake elections, and it led to his relative being prosecuted.
Wow. And yet he's back.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's him.
His reputation has recovered.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it's just the tribunes who accused him of it and nobody pays attention to the tribunes.
Oh, so. That's right. Don't listen to those guys. They're crazy.
Yeah.
And Marcus Papirius Mugulinus.
Yes, again, very familiar.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very recently was military tribune in 418.
Yep.
Quintus Fabius Vibulanus.
Again, I've heard that name before.
Consul in 423. So, you know, we're all... you know, coming about in the same sort of era.
Yes.
Spurius Nautius Rutilus,
mm-hmm.
military tribune in 419.
Noticing a bit of...
it's a bit of a trend here.
Yeah, I am.
Mm, some return of some players. Everybody sort of had a bit of a role before.
Mm.
Is this a sign of trouble afoot for Rome on the military front where they're like, you know what, we don't just need commanders, we need experienced commanders?
I think it might say something about that.
Don't give the narrative away just yet. We also have two named tribune of the plebs,
yeah,
as I understand it, Sextus Maecilius.
Indeed.
And somebody who might be Marcus Metellius, or Metellius.
All right, well, let me explain why, at least in my narrative, this all blends together a lot.
All right. I'm looking forward to the tale.
Well, yeah. Okay, so as Livy specifically notes that we do have a lot of repeat players this time around in both 417 and 416. And basically Rome is actually in quite a peaceful period externally, allegedly. I'm a little bit suspicious because there are so many military tribunes as consular power, but...
also, I mean, it hasn't been very peaceful recently.
This is true. Maybe it's just a precautionary measure. But not so peaceful internally, Dr. G.
Mm.
Once again, agrarian issues come to the fore.
Yeah, well, they didn't give me enough land. How am I supposed to live?
Yeah, well, not those issues. You might expect it would be the colonists, but it's not.
It's not coming from the new colonists of the of Labakani. Okay.
Yeah. So it's the tribunes, of course, that are causing problems. Okay, our friend Maecilius, who apparently is serving for the fourth time as tribune, and Metilius, who is apparently serving for the third time.
Oh, so we have some very experienced plebeians in the roles.
Well, again, now, this is not to say that they didn't serve, but we haven't had any record of them until this point.
Don't be like that. I mean, obviously, they're serving for the fourth and third times.
Yeah, we're just going to have to take Livy's word for it that they have served previously. So these two tribunes decide that they're going to put forward a law where land taken from the enemies of Rome should be split up and a parcel given to each Roman citizen. So effectively, what they're doing is to take away the riches of the very wealthy. And the idea is that most of the really noble gens in Rome would be hit and hit hard if they managed to pass this law.
Mm-mm.
Now, there are a lot of red flags here, in case you're wondering. So the only new territory we've really mentioned of late is, of course, Labici, right? So you might be thinking that they're referring to that land specifically, but it doesn't seem like they are. It kind of seems like maybe they mean land in general, that Rome has been founded on territory that's been, you know, gradually won and pieced together, and that's why they'd be hitting the families really hard.
Okay, that sort of inch by inch clawing it back from, I don't know, the Faliscans or something.
Well, yeah, and it's also kind of insinuating that obviously the idea is that land that is won in battle becomes part of the public land, and that the patricians are somehow monopolizing that or have monopolized that in the past, and plebeians aren't just getting a look in at all. But as we've talked about before, this isn't a rich versus poor divide. We do have wealthy plebeians. And so this kind of asks us to believe that the only way wealthy plebeians have acquired land is by buying it somehow when it comes up for sale. It just raises a lot of questions about how exactly this is working. Do they just mean the new colony? Are they referring more broadly to other things? It's a bit up in question, but certainly the tribunes feel that this is fair because they think hardly any land within Rome or outside of it has not been won by fighting, and yet the patricians hold most of the land. And so obviously this is the ill feeling that they're tapping into.
Yeah, and that seems appropriate. And it's trying to think about how would an ancient economy navigate things like this. So, like, how is wealth characterized and how do you come into the acquisition of land and how do you retain it? Because it's not like you necessarily have like a piece of paper. If we're thinking about the foundation of the city itself, you've got stones that mark out areas.
Yes.
You know, so if a family goes out and sticks some stones somewhere overnight, it's like, does that make it legal? You know, like, how does it operate in a practical sense? And if, are you capable of only possessing the things that you can fight for and then win?
Yes.
Because then your gens become super important to your land holdings, because part of the function of a gens is to come together as a warband and to protect property ownership.
Yes.
So the bigger the gens, the more powerful, the more potential. So it might not necessarily be about wealth acquisition outside in an economical sense, because that might not be the sort of power you need to be able to take land and then retain it.
Well, and this is exactly it. I think this kind of story, I mean, look, I should perhaps say that people are very dubious about whether this ever happened, because it is just such a classic conflict between the patricians and plebeians, you know, the squaring off against each other. People are very dubious about whether this actually happened, particularly because with the character of Matilius, there's been questions raised about whether that name was injected potentially by one Dionysius of Halicarnassus, because his patrons were Matilii.
Well. Yeah. Let the trash talk commence.
Exactly. But there have been questions raised certainly about the veracity of these events. However, I think if we do look at this story, it would again suggest that Rome is far more disorganized, tribal, and warlordish, which is totally a legitimate academic word, than it is being
described in our literary material from hundreds of years later.
Exactly. That Livy and Dionysius are making it seem like there's a really organized state with a very clear, you know, career progression and...
Yeah, and a highly delineated class system already in play.
Yeah, which seems unlikely if you look at this sort of story.
Well, there's no reason why you wouldn't have a hierarchical system of some kind happening, but how does it unfold in practical terms?
Yeah.
And is what these sources telling us the most likely and plausible explanation for what was happening in the past based on other things that we might be able to find out? And this is the part of the trouble that we have generally with this period is
Absolutely.
That we have so little extant material from other sources to be able to sort of co-opt into something that might be a narrative.
Yeah.
We've got archaeological remains and we've got a little bit of epigraphy and we've got this and that. And they're there, but they're not necessarily providing that wholesale sort of sweeping narrative that our writers later on are able to produce and that then go on to survive. So we're a little bit hampered by what we have access to.
Exactly. So if I am going to proceed with this story, let's obviously pretend that we believe everything Livy is saying to us.
Oh, I'm so excited for when I'm going to let you tell your story and then I'm going to maybe, I'll do some things.
Okay. All right. So the military tribunes with consular power had been consulting with the Senate. So obviously a bit more of an official public kind of consultation that's going on. But they also are having little private tete-a-tetes with the leading men. So I would read the men with the most auctoritas, potentially the most wealth, and certainly substantial political and military experience behind them. And in this narrative, definitely patricians. And they're trying to come up with an evil plan to defeat the tribunes of the plebs. Now, Livy does explicitly say at this point, so the story goes, which makes it sound incredibly like hearsay that's been passed down to generations. I know. This is where One Appius Claudius enters our narrative.
Oh,
Dr.
no.
G. Yep.
No, no. I'm still dealing with my trauma from the last Appius Claudius. They can't be back. No.
So Appius Claudius. Now, dear listeners, Roman Navy conventions strike again. This is not the Appius Claudius of infamy, but the grandson of the Decemvir, who you may be recalling, the one that had organized the potential abduction with the idea of obviously making her sexually subservient to him, of Virginia, the plebeian maiden.
Oh, yes, what a man. Who could forget?
Now, this Appius Claudius is the youngest man in the Senate.
Cute.
Yeah, I know.
How old is he?
Doesn't say. I mean, that could be 30, to be honest. I mean, even 40, really.
I was going to say, I mean, is he a spry 42?
Exactly. Now, he decides that he's going to put forward an old idea from way back in the day from his family.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, you know it's going to be awful. So this comes from not the Decemvir, but an
even earlier
back, Appius Claudius, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some disputes about exactly how great this grandfather is. Is it his great grandfather or his great great grandfather? But either way, his name is still Appius Claudius.
Doesn't matter how far back you go, it's Appius Claudii all the way down.
Yeah, we think that this particular Appius Claudius would have been his great grandfather, who was consul in 471, that he's throwing back to him.
Mm, yeah, the good old days.
Yeah. So Appius Claudius reminds his fellow senators that a good way to destroy the power of the tribunes of the plebs is by harnessing the veto power of other tribunes of the plebs. In other words, turning them against each other.
Divide and conquer, my friends.
Exactly. I do remember talking about this. He says it's not that hard because elite men in Rome just have to choose someone who's not as experienced, not as established amongst the tribunes, and use their influence to turn them against their colleagues and use them for their own advantage. Because the whole idea, of course, is that there's obviously more than just these two tribunes who are serving at this point in time. These two tribunes, however, are getting all the notoriety. They're sucking all the air out of the room, Dr. G, by causing issues and trying to win popularity with the people. What about those that are left behind in the background, Dr. G? What about the wallflower tribunes? What about them?
What about the quiet Romans?
Exactly. So instead, one way that they could advance their career path is by getting on the good side of the whole Senate, by really helping them out, doing a solid, you know, by turning on their tribune colleagues. And particularly,
what would be in it for them?
Favour. Especially currying favour with the leading senators.
Well.
Yeah. Now, the senators really like this plan because, of course, it is an evil plan.
Yeah, it's the kind of plan where they get to do exactly what they like, and maybe they have to throw a nice dinner party later and invite this guy that they don't even care about once.
Exactly. And so it is on like Donkey Kong. They are keener than mustard. All the senators are also very impressed with Appius Claudius, especially.
It's kind of hilarious. Be like, why didn't we think of that? They're like, dude, you have thought of that.
Especially Quintus Servilius Priscus, our dictator from the previous year, who's clearly an uber patrician. So he says to Appius Claudius, "You're living up to the Claudian name, you young whippersnapper. Pip, pip. Carry on." I love it.
Carrying on the great tradition of your forebears.
Yes. And so all members of the Senate are given a mission possible where they're going to talk to a tribune of the plebs and try and get them to use their veto. So through promising favours, personal gratitude, as well as also I think a bit of a mixture of, you know, threats, they managed to win over 6 of the tribunes of the plebs to their side.
Wow. And we've only got 2 names.
I know.
These
nameless traitors, Dr.
Yeah.
G. They've
infamous.
Been consigned to the dustbin of history.
For good reason. How dare you be a class traitor?
Exactly. So the following day, the Senate set the plan into motion. So they start by discussing the issues raised by Maecilius and Metilius. The leading senators then get up and make speeches about what they have proposed. All very as we would expect. They then beseech the tribunes to protect the Republic and stand against this law put forward by their colleague.
She's in danger. Somebody's got to look after her.
Yes. They were like, tribunes can do more than just create problems between the patricians and the plebeians. You can stop your colleagues from harming the state.
Yeah, you can solve problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so all the senators call on the tribunes to come to their aid in this dire hour of need. And the tribunes, who had been won over, now spoke up and said they were only too happy to use their veto against this proposal. And the Senate vouched them thanks.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm very disappointed.
I know. But
we get so close to land reform and then it just snatched away in an instant.
Yeah. Mycilius and Metilius can't really do much anymore apart from summon an assembly, call all these tribunes that agreed with the Senate turncoats and class traitors and lots of other nasty names. They rant and rave, and then they grumpily agree to put an end to their proposal.
Wow.
And that is where 417 and 416 wrap up for me.
I know, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
It is. Look, I mean, number one, it suggests that there isn't necessarily just like this clear class divide that you are a patrician or you're a plebeian. As we've talked about before, it would be highly possible if we accept that these two different classes exist, that wealthier plebeians actually have more in common with patricians than they do perhaps, you know, people who are like really low down in terms of their socioeconomic status. However, it does also suggest to me that potentially maybe some of the problems are being blamed on the plebeians. Possibly. I mean, I have no basis for this apart from the fact that I think Livy is very pro-patrician.
Yeah. So like, how does Roman politics work? And like, what are the sort of like class politics, not just class politics, but you know, how does a society function through the decisions that it has to make as a collective? Like part of the point of having something like Rome, which is functioning like a city state at this point, how does it navigate the requirements that are coming up from its citizen body? And part of that might have to be an acknowledgement that we're dealing with the cream of the crop here.
Yes.
Almost at all times. We very rarely actually get to see people, and we certainly don't get the perspectives of people who are living their daily lives in the struggle and tend to be then co-opted and levied into the army for some sort of military action. And then returned home or not, depending on what happens.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're dealing with what seems to be this sort of finicky interest group of people jostling at the very top.
Yes.
Who want something a little bit more than they've already got and can't quite agree on how they're going to make it work. And the people who have things already obviously have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. And the people who are on the edge of that are looking in and being like, I'm so close to having that. They don't want to take down the system necessarily. No. They want to be firmly embedded in the system at the very top.
Exactly. And that's also, I think, feeds into this idea. I feel like we see more corruption on the side of the plebeians than we do the patricians. It's not that you don't ever see like class traitors on either side. You do. We've talked about them before. The patrician ones tend to get killed.
There's been some great instances of patricians that have sort of elevated plebeian causes or have taken the side of the tribunes at certain points in time. But the way that our source material is navigating that is to suggest that maybe that was problematic at best.
Yeah, and I just feel like the plebeians come off in a worse light more often, particularly the tribunes of the plebs. They're either causing issues, causing problems, or they're betraying each other to get ahead. Like, it just doesn't come across. Something about it just makes me suspicious and makes me think, what are you about, young Livy?
I think it's worth being suspicious. I mean, Livy is riding under Augustus, essentially. And this means that his perspective on Rome is a very different world from the world that he's writing about in this period of his history.
True.
So there is that fact, first and foremost, but so the political context is very different. But also, who is his intended audience? Is it other Romans? And then again, which other Romans? He's writing in Latin. He's writing for somebody. So those sorts of questions start to raise themselves as well. And we're dealing with this period where, from our perspective now, we've got very little to counteract a narrative presented to us like the one that Livy offers.
Well, it's so bizarre to me because, of course, by his own time, being patrician or being plebeian, it barely matters anymore. Like, it does matter for a few things, but it's certainly not a barrier to success. You know, if you're from the plebeian classes, you can indeed be very wealthy and be involved in politics. So it's weird to me sometimes, I suppose, when we see these sorts of things. But as we talked about, that when we see the blending of patrician and plebeians gradually over time, it's still just the elite. It's just the elite that are at the top there, and therefore who he's writing for is the elite. And even though, you know, fortunes rise and fall for families and that sort of thing over time, but we do often have similar families, I think, who are going to be at the top for substantial periods of time.
I think if we're thinking about Livy and what's going on with patricians and plebeians, my flesh rabbits.
Yes.
I mean, we certainly see that some people do change from one to the other quite distinctly, and there's various ways to do that. And I think that gives us some indication of the nature of what we might think of today as class. And I'm using this as an analogy. It's not something that you could base or hinge everything on, but in the way in which a class society, and I'm thinking of the English in particular, because I think they form a great example. Australians like to think they don't have class, and that is problematic in itself. But the English definitely recognize class as a category. And if you're born into an upper middle class family, that's very different from being the lowest tier of the aristocracy. And everybody knows it. And it almost doesn't matter how much you achieve in your life. It's very different, very difficult to shift from upper middle class into the aristocracy. There is a huge barrier there.
Yeah.
So I think this is one of those things where the Romans might be in that kind of situation where it's like everybody knows precisely where you sit.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to move. Very rare cases of it happening.
Yeah.
And it does have... it probably has an effect on the way you think about yourself as a Roman.
Mm.
What kind of Roman are you? So I wonder, but I said I was going to break some stuff.
I was going to say, I'm waiting for your electrifying details, Dr. G.
Well, in the absence of my source material, I went to the secondary scholarship.
Ooh, tell me.
Well, so I was like, you know, let's find out some more about what's happening in this period if we can. Mm. What do scholars reckon might be happening? I mean, we're all dealing with very sort of small amounts of information. How do we do anything?
Yeah.
And I started reading Holloway's article from 2008, who were the Tribuni Militum Consulari Potestate.
Yes.
Who were they?
Who were they?
Who were the military tribunes with consular power?
Yeah.
And his position... or their position, I should say, because I don't know the gender of this person. Their position seems to be that what if the fasti and the list that we have for magistrates were really retrojectively made up once people started writing down history?
I think this is very much in keeping with what we've just been saying.
Yeah. So what if it is the case that, you know, people in like the first century BCE decide to write some histories and they're like, it's going to be great. And they're like, where do I start? And they're like, there are no records. There are literally no records.
There's no source material, guys.
Yeah. This is really tough. How do I write this? You know? Yeah. And what they then do is they do what we've talked about this before. They go to family archives.
Yeah.
Walk into people's houses, and people have their family trees on display, essentially, with the imagos.
Absolutely. I mean, that would definitely be a source that would exist because the Romans are super into their families.
Super into their families. And so the masks of their deceased ancestors are all displayed on the wall and, you know, presumably in some sort of order, which gives you a sense of their illustriousness or their antiquity, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But obviously that's one element of it. He then also talks about how Cicero warns everybody against believing family archives. We're like, you know, people make up some stuff for that, you know?
Well, yes, but Cicero was also fairly new.
He was a novus homo, true.
Yes.
Didn't have an ancestor to his name.
No.
So Cicero is, you know, sort of like, be careful.
Yes.
Because people exaggerate their achievements, which I think, fair call.
Yeah.
They also might falsely tell people about magistracies that they've held that they've never held.
Because he's going to be out of check.
Convenient.
Yeah.
And spurious genealogies. Like, where did your family come from? And it's like, oh, come come on. I'm a Rutilius, obviously.
Oh, this again is giving me such America, you know, 19th century vibes. Like, where does your family come from? Really?
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 Yeah, like you can just make stuff up. It's not very far back in my own family's history where people were making stuff up. I know about that, but I don't know. Don't go checking everybody. And
that's Dr. G. G with a G.
Search carefully. A single letter. What can you discover? We also have this idea that perhaps we've got the Fasti, but Holloway is kind of like, maybe we don't have the Fasti. Maybe the Fasti are a creation once people start writing that narrative history and they need to fill in the blanks. And they're consulting these family archives and there are too many names. And too many people hold too many positions.
Right.
You know, so then they get into this situation and be like, well, how do I resolve this? I got a lot of names now. And it's like, there's only supposed to be two people per year.
Yeah.
And now I've got like six people, you know, I've got like, you know, 200 names and I need to like figure out the next 25 years. Like, how am I going to do that?
So they invented a position?
I don't necessarily want to say that they did, but I think we have to put it out there as a reasonable potential, because if people are not necessarily counting things out specifically themselves within their family genealogies, they're just kind of like, I have an illustrious ancestor and they were consul three times. And that's a story that's handed down in your family.
Yeah.
So one of the stories that's handed down in my family is that we're related to Samuel Johnson.
Ooh.
I know, which is a great story, but not true.
Ah, interesting. Well, I'm related to King Henry VI, which is true because it's not a brag. He was a terrible king.
Wow. Yeah. How do you get back that far? Look at you. I didn't know I was doing a podcast with royalty.
Are you kidding? It was clearly obvious from day one.
I should have picked it. Damn it.
No, I mean, but this is the thing. This is just what I've been told. I actually have no idea whether it's true or not. I am trusting the genealogical research of my relatives, which may very well be flawed.
Interesting. Yeah. So my mother is a genealogist and maybe that's where I get my historical interest from. But yeah, she's searched far and wide to sort of back up this claim. And
yeah, no,
there doesn't seem to
yeah.
be a way to do it. So yeah. I think that sort of stuff is fascinating because that is a sort of an apocryphal story of our family.
Totally.
And you're like, well, I don't know if we can substantiate that. And, you know, that's the distance of what, 400 or something years. And I'm like, this is what happens when people tell stories.
True.
And then they're sort of reified through the retelling. Mm. And maybe they can become more exaggerated over time. And then all of a sudden you've got too many people and not enough years. And you're writing an annalistic history and you have to solve that problem somehow.
I know. They didn't have consuls. They had something else and they were allowed to have more than two.
Yes. Something with consular power.
Yes, right.
Very.
And they did military stuff with the tribes of Rome.
Fascinating, fascinating. Yes, I like it. Let's do that.
That way we can all have illustrious relatives. You get a consul and you get a consul and you get a consul.
Indeed, indeed. And so one of the other things that Holloway is pretty suspicious of is the Annales Maximi, which is the pontifical record. And
Dr. G, this is the basis for so much of your beliefs.
Just putting it out there. I'm just raising more doubts. And just, dear listeners,
yes.
If you were ever in doubt about Roman history, this is the episode for you. So there's apparently 80 books of the Annales Maximi.
Right.
And Holloway is kind of like, but they, what do they even have in them? Like, it's just going to be an oddball collection of stuff that probably doesn't make a lot of sense.
Thursday, slaughtered a chicken.
Then there are the linen books.
Ah, we talked about these before.
Yes.
This preserved, is a source of Livy.
Yeah, so, preserved in the temple of Juno Monitor and also cited by Licinius Mesa and Aelius Tubero, other writers that we only have fragments of.
Indeed, also cited by Livy.
I mean, yes,
I think the whole idea is that Livy has potentially some information from the linen books via his sources that use them.
There doesn't seem to be a consensus about the quality of the information in the linen books. So there seems there's potential for disagreement within those as well.
Naturally.
So that's good.
Mm.
And, you know, so this leaves us in a situation where what is the history of, well, we're getting rapidly towards the end of the 5th century BCE.
Yeah.
We're heading there now. But this is a period where so little is something that we can hold on to as like fact.
Well, particularly because, I mean, I don't think we've mentioned this in quite a few episodes. When we get to these really confusing times where people are saying, ah, this didn't really happen, and those people probably didn't really exist, and they're just made up names, and it starts to make you question, what am I even doing telling the history of Rome when it seems so doubtful? But as we talked about before, there is this real turning point where allegedly Rome is, you know, destroyed, razed to the ground, lots of records destroyed, and that our records will presumably get a bit more reliable once Rome itself and its record keeping is a little bit more protected from external attack and that sort of thing. But I mean, to be honest, even after that, I mean, there's still a lot of bloody fires in Rome. Who knows what's being destroyed?
Well, exactly. And I think there is always a value in considering how people writing about history within a society are thinking about their own society as well.
True.
And even if at best what we're learning is what did Livy and Dionysius and other sort of first century BC or CE authors really think about this really early period of their own history, I still think that's a really valuable sort of tool because it provides the mindset for people of the day to then think about, well, if this is what Rome is, how do I operate from here? How do I fit into this? And how can I push and change from within this context? A shared understanding of history is one that allows you to make different decisions.
Yes. And who are we to question Livy, really?
I mean, so I'm Dr. G. Yeah. And I use that as my basis for being able to question Livy at times.
I know. But I mean, realistically, though, even though he is writing many centuries after, we are podcasting thousands of years after. So I'm hoping that somewhere he had access to better sources than we do.
I mean, I'd like to think so.
I would like to think so too. All right, Dr. G, so I think that brings us to the end of our episode of 417 and 416, which was seemingly really more about 416 than anything.
Nobody got a look in from 417,
not
really.
Not really, no. But anyway.
Wow.
It's time for the partial pick. All right, Dr. G, tell us, how does partial pick work?
There are 50 golden eagles up for grabs, 10 across 5 categories.
Yep.
The higher the eagle score, the greater Rome is.
All right, so what's our first category?
Military clout.
Okay, well, there is definitely some stuff here. I mean, not so much for 417 and 416, but because I left the tail end of 418 out, we do have some victories.
We do. A victory over, what, the Aquians and the Labacani, really.
Yes, I mean, it's one of those stories where always when Rome hits problems, we then get a story very soon after where they just sweep everything before them. Effortless, easy, simple. But nonetheless, it happened.
Are you telling me there's some kind of narrative flow that you can detect in the history?
The ebbs and flows. But nonetheless, we are told that they were victorious and how. I mean, they not only managed to beat them, but they
shot up those ladders really rapidly.
Yeah, they captured their camp. They made them run away to a nearby city to take refuge. Then they captured that city and took all the booty from that. And then they set up a colony. Oh my God. That's a lot of military clout.
I'll give them 2.
What? Just because you think it didn't really happen?
No.
That seems vindictive, Dr. G.
I mean, they've only taken one place.
Do you know how long it's been since they took even one place?
Willing to up it to 3.
I think they do deserve a 3. I mean, it is a little suspicious that this guy didn't get a triumph, don't you think?
Indeed. Yeah. Very.
All right, we'll give him a 3.
Diplomacy.
No.
Yeah, it was a pretty abject failure. In fact, the patricians are trying to really ruin the potential for diplomacy internally by getting some of the tribune of the plebs on their side.
Well, I mean, I guess that is diplomatic in that they're not stabbing them in the streets. But I think there's, again, as we keep coming back to, I think there's a difference between being slightly diplomatic and mostly manipulative and actual diplomacy.
Yeah. So I'm giving them 0 for that.
I agree.
Expansion.
Yes, 1,000 times yes.
We have a whole new colony now.
We do. Oh my God.
The Labacani are probably pretty unhappy. We'll see how that turns out.
They thought they started the century unhappy.
It's only getting worse.
I know. Well, so what are we saying? We've got a colony, reasonable amount of people. They're all given a bit of land. Four?
Oh, give it a bit of land. Not enough to live off.
Well, I mean, as we say, this could just be a misunderstanding.
All right, four. Virtus.
Look, we do have some notable patrician douchebags on the scene, but I'm not sure if it's quite enough.
Yeah, I don't think they're necessarily engaging in virtus.
No, I mean, is killing your standard bearer a sign of virtus?
I feel like I need more details to be able to clarify, because it might well be, but I don't know.
I feel like no.
Citizen score.
Well, I mean, I guess there is a new colony being set up, but the way the Tribune's carrying on, I feel like it's not been good news for the people.
It does seem like they're getting the raw end of the prawn, so to speak.
Yeah, and then the Tribunes betray their cause, so that can't be...
That's not ideal if you're a citizen, no.
No, not positive. So is that a zero?
I think that might be a zero.
I mean, on the other hand, though, I'm just going to throw it out there. There is peace in 417 and 416. All the problems are internal, which means no war, no levy, able to look after your farm, see the kids.
Yeah, sure, but you're not getting any land, are you?
Not any more land.
Oofed.
I mean, this is what we've often talked about. Is the absence of war worth the point, or is it?
I think it's a case-by-case basis, but if we want them to have not an abjectly low score, perhaps we could give them one here?
Well, look, I don't mind them having a low score. I guess I'm just wondering if the absence of war is in itself something we maybe have to recognise.
I think, well, I mean, not going to war is great, but also they were trying for some things at home which didn't really get pulled off at all.
That's true.
So I feel like it's risky.
Yeah, okay, so we'll probably say a zero then.
Yes.
Okay. So that means we get a total of 7 out of 50 golden eagles for 2.5 years of Roman history.
Oh boy, ancient yeah. Rome.
You're a stinker. Don't know why I studied you for so long.
They get good later, I think.
Yeah, I've heard a rumour.
That's what I hear, but... It just depends.
Well, Dr. G, thank you once again for joining me to talk about the history of Rome from the founding of the city.
It has been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to continuing the journey with you soon.
Indeed. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Partial Historians. You can find our sources, sound credits, and an automated transcript in our show notes. Our music is by Bettina Joy de Guzman. You too can support our show and help us to produce more engaging content about the ancient world by becoming a Patreon. In return, you receive exclusive early access to our special episodes. And today we'd like to give a special shout out to our newest Patreons, Dick Karras and Vanessa. You can also support us by buying a coffee on Ko-fi. Huge thanks to Anne-Marie, Dana Gray, and Augustus, naturally, for their generous cups of support. However, if all of these avenues are beyond your means, please just tell someone about the show or give us a 5-star review. We massively appreciate your very kind words. Until next time, we are yours in ancient Rome.